Okay, well, welcome, Brad. Today is Friday, November. No, sorry, it's not. Why did I write the wrong date? Oh, because it was the one we had originally planned. Okay,
Sure.
so today is Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. My name is Catherine Katie Johnson Ringsmith. I'm the director of the NN Kennery History Project. Today, I am interviewing Brad Ingneson, and we are at the Alaska Peninsula Corporation in Anchorage, Alaska. So, thank you, Brad, and thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Okay, so let's first start with having you state your full name, and if you wouldn't mind just spelling it for me, so we make sure we get the correct spelling of your name.
Sure. It's Brad Trefon Angeson. BRADTREFON ANGASAN.
Okay, thank you. And what is your professional title?
I'm Vice President of Corporate Affairs at Alaska Peninsula Corporation.
Okay, and can you describe a little bit about where we are right now?
Physically
Yeah,
or
physically.
okay,
No,
we're
mentally. No, no,
We are
physically.
at the headquarters of APC, located in Anchorage, Alaska. APC is the village corporation for the communities of South Naknek, Port Hyden, Ugashik, Kakanak, and New Halen.
Okay, and so for those who might be listening and may not be quite familiar with the corporations, can you give me a little brief background?
Sure. We're an Alaska Native corporation. We're born from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. APC is a wholly diversified corporation. We've got two division lines, one commercial and the other for government services. Within my role, I also manage government services. I've got three operating subsidiaries that I direct as well. And those companies are engaged in construction, remediation, and administrative and general services.
Okay, great. Thank you. And you are a resident of South Naknek, correct?
I'm formerly a resident of South Naknek. My father moved us out of the community back in between 1974 and 75,
Okay.
when he began work at the Bristol Bay Native Corporation here in Anchorage. But I had the best of both worlds because I would go back every summer and, engage in the fishery, and I got to live the village life, and I also benefited from the education of the Anchorage School District.
And can you just describe geographically where South Naknek is in relation to Anchorage?
South Naknek's approximately 350 miles southwest of Anchorage, located on the Alaska Peninsula. At the apex of the peninsula, where the peninsula meets Western Alaska, basically, is where it's at.
And you said you were a young person at South Naknek.
Yeah. Well, I grew up there, and I continue to go back there every summer. So, of my 46 years, there's not been a summer that I've missed going back there. So I've seen it evolve over the course of time significantly, and 46 years is nothing, but in terms of the grand scheme of things, I guess. But in that short period of time, we've watched South Naknek evolve from a full-fledged community to near abandonment just in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the history is deep and long. In fact, it's right smack in the middle of a cultural confluence.
I would agree. I
Yeah.
think that's a great way of terming it, yes.
And your cultural affiliation?
Well, are you talking about my lineal race? I'm Alaska Native. I'm Sikh'pik. I believe that archaeologists and scientists refer to that as Alutiiq. My grandfather's family comes from Sevenoski, located in the Katmai National Park. And Sevenoski was abandoned in 1912 when the volcanic vent Novarupta blew up, which is at the base of Mount Katmai. And my father was 4 years old when he escaped the eruption. And they fled in skin Bidarka boats down the Naknek River to a location called New Sevenoski, which is approximately 5 miles upriver from where the cannery is located in South Naknek. And that's where my father, my grandfather, met his wife, my grandmother Vera Kai, and they had 10 children, three of them born at New Sevenoski, and the rest, I believe, at the government hospital in Kanakanak.
Do you have any memory of your father's parents?
Oh yeah, yeah. Great memories of my grandparents.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have pretty strong memories of Sevenoski as well.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, Sevenoski, it's really unfortunate. New Sevenoski is really unfortunate because, you know, what's left there is just the frame of the old Russian Orthodox Church. There's a couple of outbuildings that are left, but everything else has just, you know, been absorbed into the tundra.
Right.
You know?
And of course, you're talking, this is some significant world-changing events that take place at this time. You have 1912 eruption, and then just a few years later, the Spanish flu pandemic, 1919, that devastated that particular region. Do you have any memories or have heard any stories
at
that
time? Yeah, there's a lot of stories surrounding that. So The matriarch of our family, Pelagia Melganak, is my great-grandmother, and she sort of became somewhat the community savior. She brought in a lot of orphans during that time, kids that were orphaned, lost their parents, you know, during the sickness, the Great Sickness, and raised a lot of people. And It was through that my grandparents met, because my grandmother was part of that, and they sort of grew up together and then married each other, and you know, raised a wonderful family, a huge family. So eventually, my grandparents migrated down to the community of South Naknek.
You know, I was reading transcripts from the National Park Service, and in the 1980s there was an event. And I believe it was Trifon and Mary Jane who went to Katmai, and the story of the flu pandemic came up. And it wasn't clear who told the story, but they said that it was considered the sickness was transferred by money, cash, currency. And so it became a habit where they would launder
wash the coins.
Yeah.
I never knew that, but I knew that they washed their money.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
They would boil the cones and they'd literally wash the paper dollars and hang them up. So my family had talked about that, but I never knew why. I never knew the significance of that.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
That
well, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was a type of vanity.
Yeah.
You know?
A metaphor of kind of the sickness coming in through capitalism.
Yeah. Right.
So during World War I, the canneries in Alaska were canning a lot of salmon that was going to the troops fighting in the trenches in France. And what happens due to overfishing to try to keep up with the demand, the red salmon fishery crashes that same year as the flu comes in, 1919. So I imagine that was like just a 1-2 punch that just devastated the communities out there. Do you have any recollection, or are there any stories, or is it just the flu pandemic so overwhelming that the salmon crash is kind of overshadowed?
I think that you know, the recovery of that event, the 1919 pandemic, spanned generations. You know, I mean, there was a cultural recovery in addition to the physical recovery of that social group of people. And, you know, I don't really think that there was a lot of emphasis on the economic impact of the community, because really you know, the great dysfunction that followed the recovery of the pandemic was immense and really unfathomable from my perspective. I mean, it must have been an incredibly terrible time.
Yeah.
You know, not only enduring the loss of family and loved ones and maybe your parents or your siblings, but, you know, undoubtedly the government came in and, you know, took care of business. And the way that they did that was, you know, to institutionalize that generation of people, those right. who survived.
Yep.
So I was just talking to a shareholder yesterday and very, very angry. His mother was killed in you know, the 1950s, and the government came in and took him and his three-year-old brother away, and they split up the whole family.
Yeah.
And through the grace of, you know, God, basically, they somehow maintain contact with each other throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
So this individual is down south, and his brothers continue to live up here. And, you know, he just had a real tragic story. And I had known about it because Mary Jane had shared those stories with me about that particular family. So I had complete empathy for, you know, his frustration.
Yeah, we're still reeling from that event
still,
100 years later.
Oh my God, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and he was only 2 years old, and he was just a product of it.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Yeah, I find it interesting as an Alaska historian, I would say it's the most important thing that's happened in mm-hmm. Certainly in modern times, and yet very few Alaskans really understand or know what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so New Sevenoski was established,
mm-hmm.
And then very quickly, because of the flu, people began to migrate down to South Naknek, primarily because at that time, the canners who first, you know, kind of stepped in to assist people,
mm-hmm.
kind of a crisis situation, orphans were sent to Dillingham,
mm-hmm.
to the hospital there. And then I read in the reports from the superintendent that the spring fall crew was established after the 1919 pandemic. It was a way to keep those who were still living in the
mm-hmm.
near the canneries in the village to give them jobs. And of course, this is the age of kind of the entrepreneurial spirit. And but that's, I found, pretty interesting. And of course, it's not just South Naknek where the APA had canneries. It was also Diamond O and Diamond M2.
Mm-hmm.
There was clearly a village there prior to the arrival of the canneries.
I'm certain of that.
Yeah,
yeah. I've seen old footage, old Barabras, you know, where Bob and Tevier's house is.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, or Brad Markison's house now, I guess. You know, where the fish racks and the Barabra racks were just above the cannery there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certain of it. I've heard the same stories you have about you know, the old ATCO trailer office, you know, is probably on top of a couple of graves there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandma once talked about a family that lived in a old wall tent next to the cannery, right next to it, and the mother had recently died, and my grandmother had gone down to check on them and you know, did what she had to do because she was sort of the quasi health aide of the community at the time. And you know, I'm not sure what happened to that family. I'm sure, you know, somebody came in and took care of them, took them away, but you know, it was just you know, the layout of South Naknek was so much different back then because
mm-hmm.
there weren't alders, you know,
yeah,
there weren't
right.
trees. I mean, I've
yeah.
seen tons of old pictures where mm-hmm. the landscape of South Naknek is, I mean, you could see from, you know, the school all the way down to the cannery,
yeah.
and it's unobstructed, you know, whereas now you've got all these alders that have just ballooned up and forested the area.
Yeah, taken over.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, yeah, I believe that there were settlements along the way, and you know, those older native settlements, you know, they settled in groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, just in pockets all along the way there.
Well, and I imagine for the same reason APA decided to build this cannery on the Naknek River, you know, for the first time, mm-hmm. it's because it was a good location, right?
Oh, yeah.
Good place on the river, nice little stream for fresh water. Mm-hmm. But it just makes sense.
It does. Yeah. And similarly with New Sevenoski, you know, it's the same. It's a good staging area mm-hmm. because there was a creek that ran through the base of the village there and was high enough up and upriver to where, you know, tide didn't really come in and mm-hmm. and wash the banks away like they do down South Niagara. Mm-hmm. So, and it's much less exposed because it's more inland.
Gotcha. So
great staging area, I think. Mm-hmm. Ideal.
Very cool. All right, so we're going to switch directions here for a mm-hmm. second. So you and I are about the same age, mm-hmm. And we both kind of grew up at the cannery as kind of the colloquial cannery kids.
Sure.
So would you mind, I'm going to ask you a very tough question here. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling me how old you are?
I'm 46.
Okay. So you were a kid in the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
70s kid. And what do you remember about the cannery as that kid?
So as a child, okay, so I've got memories of my childhood memories of the cannery, and then my memories as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
But as a child, probably the most obvious memory is the smell of the cannery. And it's really hard to explain because there's a form of familiarity that indoctrinates a sense of home, okay? Like the smell of the cookhouse when you're walking by the cookhouse, or the smell of Davona's baking, you know, because those memories stand out the most to me. The smell of the store, you know, walking into the store and you know all the perfumes of the, you know, detergents, and you know the smell of all the merchandise, the spring merchandise that came in, you know, just really stuck with me. The smell of the boats in the covered warehouse, you know, the carpenter smell of fresh cut wood, the cedar plank boats, Steve Allen's, you know, someone like him, I mean, who just lived in sawdust. You know, those are fantastic memories. So to me, the cannery was a living organism, because it came to life and it thrived, and you know, then it would lay dormant for a little while, and you know, it was just a cycle that I was part of and have been part of for the last 46 years of my life.
And as a kid, what was your favorite building or place in the cannery?
Wow, oh my gosh, as a child, oh man, where do you begin? So there's so many curiosities about a cannery. Everything has its own appeal. I don't think that I could put my finger on one location, but you know, as a child, you know, if we got a chance to go down to the store with grandpa or grandma, that was a big deal, because we'd end up getting a candy bar, a Tootsie Roll Pop, or a can of pop, or something like that. But it was always an adventure going through there, because one, APA was, you know, it's highly controlled, so you know, they limited entry into there. If you didn't have any business being there, then, you know, you'd know it, because somebody chased you off. So there was, the, you know, the air of that element there, you know, that sort of the, what would you call it, the privilege mm-hmm. of being able to walk into the cannery and conduct whatever business that you had to do. And if I was with my grandfather or my grandmother, it must have been pretty darn important, you know. Going down to the stock room, you know, to, you know, stock up on their summer supplies or whatever, even buying gas mm-hmm. was kind of a big deal as a kid, you know, because then you go down to the stock room and, you know, somebody would come out and Frank or whoever would help you pump gas and you know, that was that. Now, so that was sort of, you know, that was the exposed part of the cannery. But within that is this sort of submersive part, which is the heart of the cannery itself, where the actual work occurs, the fish processing, you know, the egg house and the fish house and the cannery. And, you know, we're really the heart of the cannery, you know, just sort of pump life into the installation there.
There's a rhythm to it.
Oh, really? Very clearly.
Yeah.
And it was nonstop. I mean, just 24/7. It was amazing to be, you know, to walk past those canning lines at 3 o'clock in the morning. And somewhere along the way, somebody was up tending to that, even though the cannery itself, the facility would be, you know, relatively, you know, turned down for the night, but it was nonstop. I mean, I loved it. And, you know, I guess it harbors the same type of appeal that, say, New York City might appeal to somebody, where it's just nonstop, you know, it just never rests. And for a short period of time throughout the summer, that was our cannery. And, you know, the thing is with APA, I refer to it as Trident South now, and well, with APA, I've always felt a sense of ownership to that cannery. I imagine you probably do too.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And, you know, whenever I walk through the cannery, and I do it every year, I make it a general practice preseason. You know, I go over there, even though I'm not supposed to have nets and stuff over there, I still keep them over there. You know, because I don't care if Vic or anybody else or Matt tries to tell me I can't. I'm going to do it anyway. You know, it's part of who I am. It's mm-hmm. part of my cultural identity, because that's the era that I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 200 years ago, the era of my ancestors, you know, was living a very indigenous nomadic life,
mm-hmm.
and that was their culture. Now this is mine. And, you know, I'm a fourth generation commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay. My son is a fifth generation. There's a story in our family that somebody in our family, somewhere along the way, has somehow been affiliated or been employed from the start. And I don't doubt that might be true.
Yeah.
You know, because it really might. We just don't know. What we do know is we can track my grandfather's employment records, my dad's, mine, you know, and that's where it ends right there. But that's three generations mm-hmm. right there. And I had an immense sense of pride going to work for the cannery, the spring and fall crew, the beach gang mm-hmm. crew. And it was because it was really, it was a part of a tradition, you know, and I was actually carrying that. And I think I'm the last of that generation that got to do that within my family.
Yeah.
You know, my younger relatives, my cousins, will never know what it's like to have to, you know, go and you know, produce the type of manual physical labor to start a cannery up in the springtime, and then to knock it down in the fall time.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on that and kind of talk exactly what the response, what the spring fall crew was and mm-hmm. what their responsibilities were?
I refer to that group as the beach gang, mm-hmm. you know, the local beach gang, because that's what it was. It was just, you know, at that particular time, I worked with, I had the privilege of working with David Hodgson, who just mm-hmm. was an incredible laborer. Incredibly talented, incredibly smart, you know, worked, I mean, his sense of the amount of pride that he put forth in his work was incredible. It was almost militant. And he expected the same out of everybody that worked with him. And if he didn't, you weren't working with him. So it challenged everybody in that small group, in that core group, you know, to try to live up to his standards. Nobody ever could.
And David's job, I remember, was the crane driver, right?
He was the big forklift driver,
yeah.
The Crowley driver. They called it the yeah. Crowley forklift. And he operated the old yellow crane.
Right. And I would imagine, I mean, it's his job to pull those, you know, put the boats in the mm-hmm. water and pull them out. And that would be, I would imagine, one of the most primary responsibilities the cannery would have, holding the livelihoods of the fishermen and being responsible for that that process is pretty extraordinary.
You know, Katie, it wasn't just that. It was like, you know, when we pump life back into the cannery, when the barges would show up and we would offload the barges, those Connex. I remember, it might have been my last year, but David offloaded like 150 Connex containers in a really short amount of time. And it just freaked everybody out because, you know, you shouldn't have been able to do that. And he did it with an old forklift.
Yeah, there was a tremendous amount of choreography required for the process. Everybody had to know what their job was in their role, and everybody had to contribute.
Yeah, exactly. Huh. And, you know, just to really, to be part of that lifestyle then was something that young men like myself really prided themselves on. And I'm very fortunate to have been able to experience that.
So let's talk a little bit about the laundry. Mm-hmm. And what do you remember about the laundry?
Well, excuse me, can I grab a tissue? Is that one in here?
Okay. Yeah, let's go. Let's just take a break. You want to?